Hello, Penknife listeners. In this space, where we used to ask you to give us money via Patreon, we're going to instead make a dedication. After breaking news about the cancellation of a planned statue of last season's subject, Joe Orton, we ended up dealing with a whole legal mess, and it left us seriously considering throwing in the towel altogether. Details aside, it'll suffice to say that some people aren't so keen on the truth. But we're back, and with the truth in mind, we want to kick off this season with a dedication to Dr. Emma Parker and her inspiring scholarship. This season's for you, Emma.
If the world has to end, it might as well end here, and it might as well end now. I will shut it down myself, in this bleak morning, atop this desolate hill. I will end it all, because this life has become too much to bear. I have been happy, of course, so happy in these brief 17 years of existence, and there have been moments of elation when I've really felt at one with the world. But I have now lost my peace of mind, and I'm afraid it's gone forever, and that I will never find it again. I am afraid, Mother, as I follow Rudolph up this hill to our designated spot. And Mother, please, understand this. It was my word that was given, and so it was my honor, our family's honor, which was to be stained. And so I beg you, dearest Mother, to please forgive me. Is this real? Are we really here, atop this very hill, entering this bare, rocky clearing, surrounded by this silent forest of dark pines? Or is this all just an endless nightmare? Does it matter now, dearest Mother? Does it matter if we're really here? Rudolph holding a rifle, a loaded revolver in my hand. Are these all just props? Are we just two actors in a play? We are staging this duel, and all there is left for us to do is to simply follow the rules and go through the motions. First, we pin the scarlet ribbons on our chests to mark the exact point where the bullets should go in so that the blood can at long last come out. Then we make sure our firearms are properly loaded. And there is a brief moment when our eyes meet, and what we both see is so frightening there aren't words to describe it. So we remain quiet and turn around, and I start walking, my blood beating loudly in my ears. I take one step and then another, careful not to trip over the rocks until I reach the exact designated distance. And when I turn back around, the world falls silent, and all I can see is his raised arm, the rifle pointing up. So I raise my own arm and take aim, and the quiet morning is finally broken by two shots that cut through the mist and the cold, and keep echoing amongst the trees and through the forest.
What, that's it? You're not going to tell them what happens next?
Well, given the nature of our podcast, I think the listener can safely assume that one of these guys is going to turn out to be a famous writer, and the other will probably die.
Or maybe the rifles jam, so they walk down the mountain and head to their local library to artfully deface some books, and then they live happily ever after?
Eh, I don't think so. Anyway, how are you two? It's been a while.
Well, not really. I see you just about every day. Too much, even.
I mean, since we've done the podcast.
Since you've both had the pleasure of chatting with me.
Okay, this is true. I hear you're moving to Athens, Ramona?
Yeah, for better or worse, the time has come. I've been toiling in obscurity for too long. My kid needs to get away from the mouth breathers at her school. Big city life awaits. And you, Santi, any news?
Not much. Sadly, my rapping career hasn't really taken off. But you listeners can help me by heading to YouTube and listening to my track called Ice Ice Jersey.
Kozinski Ice Ice Baby.
What about you, Corey? You've got some news?
What? That I've just spent way too much time the last month being completely obsessed by Hans Falada?
Oh, I thought you were going to say you found a woman who was able to overlook the fact that you go through periods where you obsess about criminal races and was even willing to marry you.
Ah, yes, that too. She makes me even happier than Mr. Falada does.
Well, tell us about it then.
About Falada? By all means. Do you guys remember when the New York Review of Books, or NYRB, started publishing novels?
That's a press in the U.S.?
Yeah, a journal that began publishing novels in 99, but really didn't pick up steam until a few years later when they changed their designs. They're now iconic and have become veritable magnets for readers.
Yeah, it's true. When someone walks into the bookstore and goes straight for the NYRBs, you know you're dealing with a real reader.
Or someone who just likes pretty covers.
Which accounts for a good portion, if not a majority of our customers.
Again, to emphasize my non-Americanness, you'll have to explain what they publish.
The idea behind the series was forgotten classics, and I'd say more than 50% of those were in translation. They really whetted the U.S. appetite for literary work by dead foreigners, namely Europeans. And the increase in sales of translated work in the last 20 years can largely be attributed to the success of the NYRB Classics series.
Okay, but what does this have to do with anything? They didn't publish Falada, did they?
No. But at the same time they started publishing overlooked titles in translation, several other presses in the U.S. were doing the same thing. One of them was the small press Melville House in Brooklyn. They put out some great books, including a few by my beloved George Simenon, and one of their main reclamation projects was Hans Falada. To Germans, he's omnipresent, even required high school reading.
Yeah, not very exciting when it's forced down your throat. Kids would rather be drinking beers and smoking cigarettes.
More like downing monsters and sucking on vape pens.
Yeah, it's perhaps akin to what Steinbeck is in the U.S. But like Steinbeck, Falada is absolutely brilliant. He wrote page-turners that are some of, if not the best chronicles of the very interesting times he lived in, i.e. Germany in the first half of the 20th century, World War I, the fall of the Kaiser, the Weimar Republic, the rise of the Nazis, World War II, and bombed-out post-war Berlin. He wasn't a Nazi, but he also didn't leave, and for the most part kept publishing under the watchful eye of Joseph Goebbels and the Nazi culture ministry.
Thomas Mann famously declared that any books printed in Germany between 1933 and 1945 were worse than useless. He said a stench of blood and shame attaches to them, and they should all be pulped. We'll unpack this later and get into the morality of Falada's decision to stay and publish. Needless to say, it's sullied his reputation. But for now, I just want to focus on the writing itself and agree with Corey in saying that Falada's work is brilliant and should be read by anyone interested in A, literature, and B, that darkest of periods of German and human history.
And yet, no one reads him. His books are unsellable.
Well, it's his bad luck, you see. Because if I've learned one thing in my 20 years as a bookseller, it's that people absolutely judge books by their covers. And while the original Melville House covers are cool, they just don't pop or seduce the way NYRBs do. Plus, Melville House doesn't have the reach or influence that NYRB does. Had NYRB published Falada, and I'm sure they would have had Melville House not beaten them to it, I really think we'd be selling his books regularly.
Ironic, isn't it? His bad luck in posthumous publishing, when his name was a play on luck.
Indeed. Hans Falada is actually a pen name for Rudolf Ditzen, the same Rudolf we heard about in the opening scene. He chose the Falada pen name at the age of 25, when he was getting ready to publish his first, very autobiographical novel called Young Goethe-Schall, a novel about puberty.
Ah, oh, man. Every self-absorbed young white male writer used to write and somehow even publish one of those.
I can't say I'm heartbroken that era's over, though the new trend of universal self-indulgent navel-gazing isn't much better.
Regardless, he needed a pen name because he didn't want to defame his family. A few years before his death, he would say, quote, "Everything in my life ends up in my books." And in Falada's defense, his story wasn't just about the woes of Harvard life and being awkward around girls, though there was plenty of the latter. By the time he chose a pen name at age 26, he'd already had some murder, suicide attempts, and several institutionalizations under his belt.
The name he chose, Hans Falada, is taken from two Brothers Grimm stories. Master storyteller Janu is here to tell you all about it.
Sure thing, sweetheart. So Hans comes from Lucky Hans. But hold on now. Gather round, children, and let's do this bloody proper. All right. Our hero, Hans, is a bumbling young farmhand who is given a big lump of gold for his seasonal work. He starts walking home to his mother's house with the gold, which isn't the easiest thing to carry, and comes across a geezer on a horse. The guy on the horse convinces him he'll be better served with a horse than that huge lump of gold, and Hans, stupidly enough, trades him. But the horse is difficult to ride, and Hans comes across a farmer with a cow who sings the praise of his beautiful cow. So Hans happily trades the horse for the cow. But the cow is old and gives no milk, so when he runs into a butcher with a pig, he trades away the pig, and so on and so on. He trades the pig for a goose, and then somehow he trades the goose for a bloody stone grinder and some stones, so that after starting with gold, all he's ended up with is rocks. But here's the thing. After each time getting swindled, our Hans feels like he's the luckiest geezer in the old bloody world. He buys what they tell him hook, line and sinker and maintains perfect optimism and belief in the good nature of his fellow man. Eventually, he accidentally knocks his stones into a well and then congratulates himself on his good luck for becoming unburdened.
So, he's like an enlightened Zen fool with horrible luck who sees his nearly empty glass full to the brim.
He's pretty much the opposite of me, and in many ways he's the opposite of Rudolf Ditson, who was a master at perceiving human pettiness, greed, and ugliness. But there was a part of Ditson, who we will refer to as Hans Falada for the rest of the podcast, that shared some of Hans's naivete and belief in the good nature of humanity. Addiction, poverty, constant incarceration and institutionalization, and even war and the Nazis couldn't fully shake him of that.
His last name is great too, taken from the story The Goose Girl.
All right, kiddos, I got another one for you. So while traveling to meet her betrothed prince, a princess is forced by her servant maid to switch clothes with her. When they arrive, the maid presents herself as a princess and the princess is forced to tend to the kingdom's geese. One of the horses the two women rode in on happens to have the ability to speak, so the fake princess orders it beheaded so that he doesn't spill the bloody beans. But then the real princess, now the goose girl, asks for his head to be nailed above a gateway. There, the bloody decapitated horse's head talks, doesn't it? The truth is revealed and the impostor is put naked in a barrel full of nails and dragged to death, and everyone, aside from her and the dead horse, live happily ever after. The talking beheaded horse responsible for this happy, heartwarming ending was named Falada.
All right, well, there you have it. His name is Hans Falada, and my name is Santiago Lemoine, and I'm a writer, bookseller, and I used to be a true crime fan from Buenos Aires.
And I'm Corey Eastwood, and I'm a bookseller, writer, and sadly, I'm still a Yankees fan from New York.
And I'm Ramona Stout, and I'm a writer about to launch myself into big city life after more than a decade adrift.
You're listening to Penknife, a podcast about writers who may or may not have written about crime, but who definitely committed it. This is season 3, Little Men, What Now? The Life and Times of Hans Falada. Like our previous seasons, this one is a series. We're telling one story in 5 parts, so we encourage you to listen to the episodes in order.
Hans Falada is born in northern Germany in 1893 in Greifswald, a university town nestled right on the coast of the Baltic Sea. Falada's father is a well-off court magistrate who likes to regale his son with tales of the cases he presides over, assault, rape, and infanticide included. His mother grew up in the home of an uncle, who is a lawyer, and like her husband, she's well-educated and well-read. There are lots of books in the Falada household, and from an early age, young Hans uses them to escape.
The typical story of the loner who likes animals more than other kids, who's sickly and therefore picked on, and who with the help of books develops an oversized faculty for fantasy.
Well, yes, but his first years in Greifswald are rather comfortable, and there's no real need to escape anything through books until he moves to the big city. That happens in 1899, when Hans is 6 and his dad gets a prestigious appointment to the courts in Berlin.
The turn of the century is a time of rapid growth in the German capital. In 1900, it becomes the first European city to get trolleys. And 2 years later, the first intercity railway, the S-Bahn, starts running. In 1904, the first department store opens its doors. Decades later, a store like this will play an important role in Falada's novel, Little Man, What Now?, to illustrate the miserable state of not only the working class, but white-collar workers as well. But in the beginning of the century, young Hans and his family view it as a paragon of growth and possibility.
Of course, not everyone feels this promise. Not everyone lives in a 7-room apartment in the posh neighborhood of Charlottenburg. The proverbial other half aren't experiencing the same benefits of industrialization. At this point, Berlin is Europe's most densely populated city, and 750,000 people live in 1-room apartments. These people, who constitute the vast majority of the defendants in Dad's court, fascinate young Hans.
So maybe, even though he has plenty of luck materially, he identifies with those less fortunate than him, because in other areas of life, he doesn't have the best fortune.
No, he does not. He names himself Hans after Lucky Hans, but he'll also later refer to himself as Pechvogel, which translates to someone who is accident-prone and has the worst luck. As a kid, he catches every disease that's going around, falls down every set of stairs, and gets caught every time he tries to cheat on an exam. This is a story related by his biographers, but it's also part of his own self-mythologizing and self-justification for his later problems with addiction, the typical alcoholic junkie explanation for their using. You don't know how hard I've had it, man.
But it's true. He's a sickly kid who gets bullied all the time, suffers from masturbation guilt, and who's called by his Latin teacher at age 13 slightly imbecilic.
Well, it's a well-established scientific fact that jerking off too much will turn you, at the very least, slightly imbecilic.
His favorite trick for getting out of school is to drink huge amounts of vinegar, which apparently gives your skin a deathly pallor.
His luck really turns bad in 1909, when he's 15 and the family's just moved to Leipzig, because Dad's been appointed to the Imperial Supreme Court there. Hans has been cramming for an exam he needs to pass in order to move on to the next grade. And the day before he's set to take it, he's riding his bike when he gets run over by a horse-drawn butcher's cart. Along with one of the wheels crushing his foot, the horse kicks him in the face. And when he gets to the hospital, doctors don't expect him to make it through the night.
Yeah, no wonder he names himself after a beheaded horse.
It's a long recovery in which he suffers through bad headaches and dizzy spells and has more reason than ever to isolate and wrap himself up in books.
And masturbate and feel guilty?
Actually, Wilde and Nietzsche are his favorites these days, and this contributes to a full rejection of the Christian faith he's grown up in. It also contributes to his growing reputation among his peers as a bad boy, a rebel. During a speech he gives to the literary society at his school, he declares, "Modern schools can only produce criminals and madmen."
He definitely does his best to support this claim. Along with writer, criminal and madman are two of his other most prominent identities.
You could also add addict, womanizer, thief, and of course, mayor to that list.
Mayor? Wow, I'm excited to hear how Hans succeeded where my boy Norman Mailer failed.
Well, we'll get to that later. But in 1910, when he's 17, Hans catches typhoid, and that's when things really take a turn for the worse. His mother says, quote, "From then on, he was very strange, extremely uncommunicative, and shut himself off from us as much as possible."
That autumn, he writes to a literary buddy of his, Hans Dietrich von Necker, a friend of a friend from Berlin, and they begin a passionate epistolary friendship. He tells von Necker that he's had more than enough of life and wants to off himself.
Von Necker, as we'll soon learn, is very obliging of his friend's whims. And the first time they meet in person, when von Necker visits Leipzig during the Christmas holiday, he brings Falada poison to do the deed.
The poison failed, and so too does a subsequent attempt to slit his own throat.
Falada isn't alone in trying to kill himself. Suicide among young people is in vogue in Germany, and in a period of 10 months, three of Falada's classmates take their own lives. After the first suicide, the school principal blames the young man's death on, quote, "unsuitable reading material that affected the balance of his mind."
It's interesting, because he's probably right. The writer Johannes Becker, who was a contemporary of Falada, also tried to kill himself in the same period. His failed attempt was directly modeled on the German romantic writer Heinrich von Kleist's 1811 joint suicide with his girlfriend. And the romantics, who were definitely fans of suicide, were in fashion again in the early 20th century, along with our guy Nietzsche, whose nihilistic view of the world doesn't necessarily offer the most hope, at least to impressionable young readers.
Well, depending on how you read him.
Today, the conversation around youth suicide is focused on social media. Bullying is amplified by TikTok and Instagram, and recently there have been too many stories about the role it played in young people, primarily teenage girls, deciding to end their own lives. In the 80s, it was the Satanic Panic and heavy metal albums that were to blame for the generation's morbid discontent. And in Germany, in the beginning of the 20th century, the culprit was what we now refer to as high literature.
Well, that's a proud German tradition, you know. Copycat suicide is credited as first originating after the publication of Goethe's The Sorrows of Young Werther in 1775, when Werther fever swept through Germany and, along with dressing like the lovelorn protagonist who offed himself because of unrequited love, many a sad young man also took his own life because some girl didn't like him back.
Today we call them incels and school shooters.
You're joking, but tragically there's a lot of truth in that. School shootings in the US are probably the most common contemporary form of copycat suicide, or what's called the Werther effect.
Anyhow, it's during this suicidal period that Falada really starts to view himself as a writer and to commit himself to the craft. And what type of writing do lonely young men like more than any other?
Sonnets that rhyme me with bee and love with dove?
Close. The love note, of course. These are anonymous and mildly obscene, and when Falada's friend is accused of being their author, Falada's solution, rather than to own up to what he's done, is to kill himself.
Luckily, though, his parents intervene when his mum finds him writing a suicide note and send him to a psychiatric sanatorium. His doctor there, who you can imagine looking somewhat like Freud in an impeccably groomed suit, says of the wayward young writer that he is an undernourished narcissist who had, quote, a very inflated view of his talent as a poet and a writer. The pieces of his work, which I have seen, have very little literary value.
Sounds like my editor.
Well, your editor and the doctor can go to hell. Hans believes in himself, so much so that he and his buddy who brought him the poison, Hans Dietrich von Necker, decide they'll each write a piece of literature, and that the person whose writing is judged inferior by a third party will be shot.
Wow, damn, now we're talking. That's some high-stakes prose.
Well, if he's suicidal, and clearly he is, I'm not so sure it says much about his confidence in his writing. Perhaps losing the literary competition is just the easiest way out.
I think more literary contests should be this way. We'd limit the number of bogus entries the judges have to read.
Yeah, it would really separate the men from the boys. Proverbially, that is. I guess we don't say that anymore.
Regardless, it never happens. Their next plan is to stage a duel and to kill each other that way. They choose the duel because A, it might be seen as more honorable than joint suicide, and it would spare their families some shame, and B, because everyone knows real writers duel. There is no more OG way for a writer to settle a disagreement. From Cervantes to Pushkin to Lermontov, all the greats dueled.
There's a future penknife season or two on dueling writers, but let's get on with Falada and his friend von Necker.
Right. On October 16th, 1911, the day before the boys are set to kill themselves, Hans Dietrich von Necker writes,
I love my friend Rudolf Ditzen,
a.k.a. Hans Falada,
very much. He exercised a strange power over me. He was able to subject me completely to his will. The mistake I made, which is responsible for all the terrible things which have happened, is that I was too weak to break off our friendship when that was still possible. Once I had fallen under his spell, it was too late. One day, a lovely day, when I was once more under his influence, I gave him my word. I gave it freely to help him carry out his plans.
He goes on.
I do not go willingly to my death. I was so happy. My word of honor given so carelessly is to blame for everything. I beg you, dear mother, forgive me.
The creative nonfiction scene we began the episode with ended after the first shots were fired. We stopped there for a bit of the old dramatic effect. You know, some cliffhanger action to trick you morbid listeners into listening to a bunch of boring talk about books while you're waiting to hear about blood and gore. But mainly we stopped there because that's when the scene with all the classic elements of romanticism comes to an end. From then on, it goes full comedy, or, well, tragicomedy. They miss each other with the first shot, and then von Necker has to come help the bumbling Falada reload his rifle because he has no idea how to do it himself. In fact, he barely knows how to fire a gun, while von Necker, apparently, is a first-class sharpshooter.
They seem to have accounted for this handicap by Falada getting a rifle that can easily hit a target at 80 yards, and von Necker using a rifle that's barely able to hit a target at 30 paces. So it's no surprise that when they finish reloading and take their paces again, von Necker misses on his second shot.
But Falada hits a bullseye. He runs to his friend who lays on the ground bleeding from his chest. Von Necker begs him to end it, and Falada obliges, using von Necker's revolver to shoot him again, this time killing him. He then turns the gun on himself.
The last two bullets both connect but don't kill him, and he stumbles down the hill bleeding until a forester finds him and eventually gets him to a hospital. There, doctors determine that a bullet has injured his lungs and come very close to his heart.
Again, doctors are sure he isn't going to make it through the night. But again, Falada makes a full recovery.
Physically, sure, but socially and psychologically, there's no glossing over the fact that he'd just killed his friend.
The initial charge is murder. That means there won't be any going back to school, nor university, nor is there any more chance that he'll follow in Dad's footsteps and become a lawyer. The future's looking bleak.
But his family's privilege and power isn't all lost. as there's a good chance it plays a role in a doctor's ruling that December that declares that at the time of the killing, Falada's mind was so disturbed that he could not have exercised his own free will. Thus, he's declared mentally ill, and instead of prison for murder, he gets shipped off to the Tanafield Sanatorium. We began this episode explaining how Rudolf Ditson took the pen name Hans Falada from Grimm's Fairy Tales. But it just occurred to me that there's got to be another reason, one that's probably obvious to many of the listeners, for why he chose the name Hans.
What's that?
Well, his friend was called Hans Dietrich von Necker. Now, all the bullying, the sickness, the weakness, all those things led him to books, led him to writing, and to, as we'll see, developing other unhealthy coping mechanisms. But think about it. You don't just kill your best friend when you're 18 and walk away from it. That's got to weigh on anyone. Yeah, he went to therapy, but he wasn't a Christian and had no God to confess to, nor did he have AA or meditation. He just had to live with his deed.
So part of his repentance was taking his lost friend's name in homage?
Strange way of going about it, if you ask me, but why not? Can you imagine what von Necker's parents thought when Falada started to get famous? Here's the guy who stole our son from us by literally manipulating him to death, and now he's stealing his name? Some homage that is.
Well, this season we'll learn whether or not he did the name justice. Now, though, we'll say goodbye to Falada as he's beginning his first, but definitely not his last, extended stay in the sanatorium. Next week on Penknife, we'll hear about how our lucky Hans copes with the fallout from his tragic childhood. The sneak peek answer is drugs, booze, and writing. These things take him in and out of institutions and prisons and eventually bring him to the height of literary fame. It's a redemption story in the works, a veritable happy ending. If only it wasn't for Hans' bad luck of living at a time of very interesting political developments.
Hey listeners, it's been brought to our attention that in this episode, when we discussed the fact that Hans Falada was rediscovered and published by the indie press Melville House, that we unintentionally took a swipe at them by saying that Falada isn't as popular as he should be because they published him instead of NYRB. The point was absolutely not to slight Melville House, which is a fantastic small press in a country that is in desperate need of more small presses like them. Instead, we were just trying to point out that readers tend to judge books by their covers, and thus, when they're looking for a book by a forgotten European writer in translation, they often pick up an NYRB title when they should probably be getting themselves some Melville House Falada. So sincere apologies to Melville House. They are an excellent press, and we highly recommend you check out their catalog and go buy a few of their titles.
Penknife is created, written, and produced by Corey Eastwood, Ramona Stout, and me, Santiago Lemoine. Hans Falada is voiced by Finn Lobsin, and a special thanks in this episode to Janu Zigo for the Grimm's Fairy Tales. Janu is an espiritista, shaman, and storyteller. You can contact him for consultations and much more at shamagica.com. The sound design, music, and all things audio are the work of Diego Sanchez of La Pianola Studio in Buenos Aires. The logo and all things visual have been made by Nelly Cuellar Torres. Flor Lopez built our website, penknifepodcast.com, where you can find a full bibliography of the works we used in researching this episode. And again, thanks to Elurbster for letting us turn his spare bedroom into a recording studio. If you like what you're hearing and want to help us out, the best thing you can do right now is to rate and review Penknife on Apple Podcasts, subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to us right now, and tell your friends about the show. We're not going to lie to you. We've made these 3 seasons ourselves with very little financial support, and it's been a struggle. We really want to continue to make Penknife, but in order to do so, we need your likes and reviews. Even if you think it's shit and you just want to chime in to tell us to stop wasting our time and money making this podcast, we'd love to hear it.